Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining our July Coalition call. I hope this finds everyone still healthy and safe. Before we get started, if everyone can mute their phones so we don't have any background noise during our presentations, that would be fantastic, and we appreciate it. In the wake of the killing of George Floyd, our nation and our communities have undergone a much-needed conversation on how we reform policing in America. A critical component of this conversation has included a debate on how and whether law enforcement should be responding to calls involving a person's mental health. In light of these critical conversations, we thought it would be a good opportunity to highlight different strategies and approaches taking place across the country when it comes to interactions with those living with mental illness. In the country as a whole, mental health situations are responsible for about 1 in 10 police calls. Many stem from undiagnosed conditions unknown to police and first responders. And sometimes the consequences can be tragic. 40% of adults with serious mental illnesses will come into contact with the criminal justice system and law enforcement during their lives. Each year, 2 million of them are booked into jails. Most are charged with minor misdemeanor crimes and low-level felonies directly tied to their psychiatric illnesses. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, or also known as NAMI, reports that the average cost of jailing someone with a serious mental illness is $31,000 per year, compared to $10,000, which would be the annual cost of providing community-based help. It's estimated that $918 million was spent by law enforcement in 2017 simply on transporting people with severe mental illnesses for evaluation and care. Police officers, behavioral health providers, and community stakeholders face challenges in determining and implementing the proper ways to intervene during behavioral health crises. Unfortunately, as a result, interactions with people with mental illness in crisis often result in actions that significantly hurt recovery. But it doesn't have to be this way. The movement underway to, quote, defund the police, unquote, is a long-needed moment to review and revise the strategies our communities used to respond to and take care of those living with mental illness. Several communities have moved to reduce police involvement by creating systems that attempt to minimize law enforcement response. For example, in Colorado, a pilot program where behavioral health clinicians ride with police officers during 911 responses and routine patrols has been incredibly successful and is being expanded from 3 police departments to 12. In 2017, behavioral health clinicians assisting police officers in Denver made contact with nearly 1,000 people suffering mental health issues. Only 2.4% of those encounters resulted in an arrest, while 334 people were connected to formal outpatient mental health treatment. Most other encounters resulted in de-escalation of the incident. The experience of the Denver Police Department was mirrored in Boulder County, Colorado, where nearly 44% of encounters with people suffering mental health issues resulted in follow-up care rather than arrest and incarceration. The pilot program in Boulder County is estimated to have cost $600,000, but saved the state more than $3 million in jail costs due to fewer arrests and incarcerations. Possibly one of the most comprehensive examples of local mental health response is in Houston, Texas, where since 1992, the police department has developed a mental health division considered to be a national model for dealing with mental health-related incidents. In 2015, it was selected by the U.S. Council of State Governments as a learning site for specialized police responses for the mentally ill. All CIT-related calls are co-attended by one of the division's crisis response teams, who also conduct ongoing assessments of mental health and refer for treatment when necessary. In addition, the Mental Health Division supports Houston's Chronic Consumer Stabilization Initiative, which works closely with state, VA, and charitable organizations to advance mental health care in the Houston community. As we all know, mental health is a complex social issue that has been neglected for a generation. However, as we have demonstrated in the examples just laid out, state and local governments are on the front lines of changing this for the better. These initiatives and approaches are literally saving lives. And that is why today's topic is so important. I hope our call gives you some insight into some of the ways localities and organizations are innovating and leading on this issue, with the hopes of giving you strategies to replicate certain approaches in your own communities. We have a great slate of speakers today, starting with Dr. Michael McCray. Dr. McRae serves as the Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of Health and Promotion for Justice Impacted Populations at New York City's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Dr. McRae will be discussing the City of New York's mobile crisis teams and health engagement assessment teams, also known as HEAT teams. First, some quick background. In New York City, our mobile crisis teams are dispatched by NYC Well, which is our city's 24/7 mental health helpline, to respond to urgent mental health care needs, often serving adults and children directly in their homes. Teams can include nurses, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, community liaisons, and peers. Services include assessment, crisis counseling, and referral to ongoing care and social services. These teams can provide limited follow-up services, and they operate 7 days a week with extended business hours and respond in 2 to 48 hours, depending on the situation's urgency. Our HEAT teams are composed of one clinician and one peer, usually a person with lived experience in mental health, substance use disorder, or the criminal justice system. And our HEAT teams proactively engage people at risk of mental health crisis, connecting them to community-based care and social services, getting to them before a crisis occurs. And to dive deep into this, I now hand the floor over and the call over to Dr. McRae. And Dr. McRae, if you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice, and the floor is yours, sir.
Okay, hello. Thank you to the Coalition for asking me to speak about our mental health response teams here in New York City. As you mentioned, my name is Michael McRae. I am the Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of Health Promotion for Justice Impacted Populations at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And really our kind of focus is really minimizing the impact of justice system involvement at the individual as well as community level. Today I'm going to speak specifically around the HEAT team, as was mentioned earlier, as well as the mobile crisis teams. So just to kind of I'll start with the HEAT teams. As was mentioned, the HEAT team stands for Health Engagement and Assessment Team. This program really supports individuals in the community presenting with behavioral health challenges and or health concerns that are impacting their daily functioning. And we see it as providing an alternative public health response to community-based mental health and substance use issues that are really better served by engagement, counseling, linkages to services, rather than the kind of traditional law enforcement or even an EMS response. There are kind of two parts to this this work here. And as was mentioned earlier, each team consists of a clinician and a peer. This first prong is around direct community engagement, and it's more a prevention kind of strategy. This team focuses on engaging community members in areas of the city with the largest rates of behavioral health calls to 911, drug-related hospitalizations, psychiatric hospitalizations, and justice system involvement. And we see these as social determinants of health that really result from longstanding structural racism. So we center our work in equity and anti-racist practice in order to really meet the needs of the communities that we serve. And so kind of in this encounter, or in this kind of activity, the clinician and the peer would go out to the communities. In this case, in many cases, we're thinking around engaging communities hardest hit by COVID, but also who had the other kind of social determinants of health, and really doing proactive engagement around talking about mental health, helping people think around their social determinants of health, getting there. Helping them get access to housing, to food stamps, to all the things that we know really impact mental health. And also, we have been very successful at naloxone training as well. In 2019 alone, we distributed about 2,300 kits. And then more than 2,300 people were trained in opioid overdose prevention. So we see that as a very good strategy for that community piece. The second piece is more on the kind of crisis and crisis prevention as well. This is where referrals come from NYC Well, which is the city's 24/7 connection to free and confidential crisis counseling, mental health and substance use support, information and referrals. And so in this model, in this piece right here, the heat team will deploy to kind of with the location of the concern and really proactively kind of inform assessments, lots of ongoing clinical services, as well as peer counseling from the peer. And they hold them for up to 2 months, just to kind of 2 or 3 months, just to make sure that their basic needs are being met. As we know, these basic needs are often correlated with justice system involvement and entanglement with the legal system. One of the great things about this, around this, this model here too, is that we can be very flexible in kind of where we go and what we respond to. So we can also deploy to emergency circumstances. So currently we have some of the peers on the ground in Brooklyn, where there has been a recent increase in gun violence, where a one-year-old was shot and killed while a family was at a barbecue. It was on July 12th. So navigators are helping the community in crisis. They're trying to mitigate, further mental crises by engaging with community members, both the family and surrounding community around trauma, mental health, violence, participating in marches, providing masks. So we see that as a very, we're very kind of happy that we're able to kind of provide that kind of crisis response and really have these conversations with community around policing and around violence in the neighborhoods and around mental health as well. In this program alone, we, 2019, we had around almost 650 referrals to the program. And we actually accounted about 577 of them. And amongst those folks, we had about 2,200 total encounters. So really making sure we're having regular contact with folks and connecting them to services, oftentimes legal services as well. So I'm going to jump quickly to the mobile crisis team and try to not take too long here. So general mobile crisis teams, they respond to urgent medical needs. General mobile crisis teams mostly serve adults and, as was mentioned, some children in their homes. They do assessment, crisis counseling, referral to ongoing care and social services. They provide kind of time-limited follow-up services. Multidisciplinary teams, as was mentioned, it's operated by hospitals as part of their licensed CPEP, or comprehensive psychiatric emergency programs, or by CBOs in contract with DOHMH, and they sometimes dispatch their own mobile crisis teams for their own clients. So for example, if a person recently was treated and released from their CPEP or discharged from the inpatient psych unit, and they didn't show up for the next scheduled outpatient appointment, they might dispatch their own mobile crisis team to visit first at home or in the community. The general public can access mobile crisis through NYC Well, which dispatches referrals to the most appropriate 19 teams operating citywide. About 59% of the referrals come from outpatient mental health providers concerned about one of their clients, usually because they didn't show up for an appointment. About almost 20% are from concerned family members of friends or friends, and the remainder are a variety of different non-mental health service providers. 7 days a week, I forgot to mention the heat team earlier is 8 to 8. In terms of being kind of active, pre-COVID, we were on the ground at that time. But the mobile crisis team responds within 2 to 48 hours, depending on the situation's urgency. And so they generally service about 20,000 referrals annually. And about 61% of people who are referred to services actually attend their first appointment. So those are our successful linkages. Children's mobile crisis, it provides kind of a rapid response care and short-term crisis management, it provides that for children, teens, and families who need crisis assessment, crisis stabilization, prevention planning, and caregiver support. We're here in New York, so you hear the sirens in the background. All children's mobile crisis teams consist of licensed clinical staff with an advanced degree in counseling as well as family advocates. Children mobile crisis teams, they provide a rapid response, like I said, within two hours of receiving a referral between the hours of 8 a.m. and 10 p.m. and a phone response within 30 minutes between 10 p.m. and 8 a.m. And so, as was mentioned earlier, they offer assessment, crisis intervention, supportive counseling, referrals, and linkages to services. And it's available for youth that are up to 21 years old, so including some transitional age youth as well. And that's also access to NYC Well. I don't know. I think I'm at my time limit, but I wanted just to kind of give a brief overview of those programs here in the city.
Thanks, Dr. McCray. And we have a few minutes for some questions here. So if you have a question, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. We had a few that came in via the registration form, so I'll go with that first. Dr. McCray, if when it comes to the call coming in initially to NYC Well, how is the level of response determined? Is that by NYC Well or is that by someone within the mobile crisis unit itself?
So NYC Well is kind of the city's hub for mental health services. So you call into there, there is a description of kind of what's going on. NYC Well will kind of triage it, send it to the appropriate program, and that program decides or is kind of responsible for how quickly that happens.
Great. And then if one more before we open it up, if I was a city or a county looking to replicate the mobile crisis response team, where would you suggest I start?
I would start, I would think about the CPEPs, the hospitals, because those are going to be kind of your such a crucial partner in the process.
Any questions on the line? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. I'll give it a moment for folks to get in the queue. Going once, twice. Thank you, Dr. McCray, for your presentation today, and I'll send out more information on the program as soon as the call's over in case folks want additional information. So we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now for our second presentation today, we are thrilled to have with us Tim Black, who serves as the Director of Consulting at the Whiteberg Clinic in Eugene, Oregon. For some brief background, 31 years ago, the city of Eugene, Oregon developed an innovative community-based public safety system to provide mental health first response for crises involving mental illness, homelessness, and addiction. Whiteberg Clinic launched CAHOOTS, also known as Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets, as a community policing initiative in 1989. The CAHOOTS model has been in the spotlight recently as our nation works to reimagine public safety. The program mobilizes two-person teams consisting of a medic, which could be a nurse, paramedic, or EMT, and a crisis worker who has substantial training and experience in the mental health field. The CAHOOTS team deals with a wide range of mental health-related crises, including conflict resolution, welfare checks, substance abuse, suicide threats, and more, relying on trauma-informed de-escalation and harm reduction techniques. CAHOOTS staff are not law enforcement officers and do not carry weapons. Their training and experience are the tools they use to ensure a nonviolent resolution of crisis situations. They also handle non-emergent medical issues, avoiding costly ambulance transport and emergency room treatment. Whiteberg CAHOOTS provides consulting and strategic guidance to communities across the country that are seeking to replicate the CAHOOTS model. And with that, I will turn the call over to Tim to present on this. And Tim, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice.
Great. Thank you so much for that introduction. To really talk about the CAHOOTS program, we do need to start by just very briefly kind of understanding where our organization, Whiteberg Clinic, got its start. Whiteberg Clinic is a federally qualified health center that serves Lane County in Oregon. The metro area where our clinic is located has about 250,000 folks. We have in our community approximately 4,000 folks who are unhoused by name, according to the most recent count. So we have a pretty large population that we're working with in a fairly small community. Our per capita rate of homelessness is one of the highest in the nation. And that's not a new thing for us. So in the late 60s and early 70s, the founders of Whiteberg Clinic were seeing a lot of the same cultural issues that were being experienced by other West Coast cities, particularly Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco. And in late 1969, our founders really wanted to try and find a way to provide an alternative to the traditional systems of response in our community, and started by really looking at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic as an example of a successful program utilizing harm reduction and community-based services to really meet the needs of patients in a way that wasn't being offered on a large scale. And that was really the impetus, you know, like I said, behind bringing Whitebird Clinic to be. The first things that Whitebird Clinic offered were crisis services. Before we even had a brick and mortar location, we had a crisis line that rang to our founder's living room. That same phone number is still ringing off the hook 24/7 now, 51 years later. As we started to get those crisis calls, as we started to open up a walk-in clinic, we recognized really quickly that there was a need for there to be some sort of community-based response as part of this crisis system that we were trying to develop. And born out of that need for community-based crisis response and a desire to really provide folks with a therapeutic intervention rather than unnecessary contact with law enforcement or fire and EMS services, Whitebird Clinic started to try and find ways to really engage with folks in crisis out in the community. We started off by receiving calls to our hotline and then activating what we called the Bummer Squad, a group of volunteers that would go out in personal vehicles with the first aid kit and just talk with somebody where they were, offer them a ride to a service, bring them back to Whitebird Clinic, or even just, you know, kind of sit with them and have that conversation in their home or in a park. As that program grew, we really found an opportunity with the city of Eugene to formalize this community-based crisis response. And by plugging it into the public safety system, all of a sudden they were going to have access to all the calls that were going to the police and fire departments for whom a behavioral health first response was the most appropriate resource to send. And that took the form of CAHOOTS with our first shift on July 4th of 1989. We have always been integrated into the public safety system, which means that our responders out on the streets with CAHOOTS right now are using a police radio to receive all of their dispatch calls. That allows us to respond not just to the folks that are calling for CAHOOTS services, but as civilian, you know, behavioral health first responders working within that system, we're able to respond to all of those calls that are coming through 911 where there's not a crime being committed, you know, something's not on fire, there wasn't a car crash, so there's not a need for police or fire and EMS services, but there does need to be some sort of first responder that can go out and engage with that individual. And that really is what CAHOOTS is there to really offer to our community. You know, as was mentioned in the introduction, we offer a really broad range of services. There are a lot of different things that CAHOOTS teams are able to do when they go out on a scene. A lot of that has to do with the makeup of our team. As was mentioned, with that EMT and that crisis worker, you know, we're able to really engage in a lot of really meaningful harm reduction conversations, specifically around addiction. You know, we're able to really work with folks in some really profound ways. One big example that comes to mind for me is when I first started working on the CAHOOTS team 10 years ago, we responded to a call for a woman who had been reported as a prowler at her apartment complex. She was described as being in various states of undress and peering into neighbors' windows, knocking on doors, trying to get into different apartments. And so a CAHOOTS team was sent because there wasn't any sort of real aggression or escalation, just some really unusual behavior. Things started to escalate while the CAHOOTS team was en route, and so an officer was dispatched. Officer made first contact with the woman at her apartment and secured the scene. She was completely undressed and really, really escalated. The officer knew that CAHOOTS was coming, so they didn't engage with that individual. They waited for the CAHOOTS team to show up. And when we responded to the scene, we were able to de-escalate the woman verbally. And while the crisis worker was having a conversation with this woman about what was going on, the medic was looking around to see, you know, are there any medications? Is there anything to indicate that there are other considerations that need to be made here? In that evaluation, we discovered that this woman had been diagnosed with a urinary tract infection and had not been taking antibiotics and was experiencing psychosis as a result of the sepsis. Because CAHOOTS was responding to that situation, we were very quickly able to recognize that what we were seeing was a medical emergency and not some sort of escalated behavioral health situation. And for me, that really drives home the need for there to be this type of behavioral health first response within that larger system. You know, because if Cahoots hadn't been there for that woman, chances are she would have been arrested and taken to jail on a disorderly charge. And it wouldn't have been until medical staff of the jail did an assessment that they would have recognized that she was experiencing a medical emergency. You know, there are countless situations like that that occur day in and day out for Cahoots teams and the patients and the community that we serve. From those humble beginnings in July of 89, we have grown our program to the point where we now provide 24/7 coverage to our metro area with a total of 60 service hours per day. That means that overnight we have two vans responding to the Eugene Springfield metro area. We bring a third van on during our peak hours. And that depth of response has brought us to the point where in 2019, Cahoots teams responded to 24,000 calls for service. That makes up nearly 1 in 5 of the total calls that are coming through the public safety dispatch system here in Eugene and Springfield. And we were able to save our community upwards of $20 to $25 million in diversions from police contact, diversions from jail, and diversions from the hospital systems. We're doing that all on a budget of about $2.1 million annually. So there's a tenfold return on investment to the Eugene and Springfield community just by having Cahoots out there responding to those crises rather than police and fire and EMS. Additionally, because Wiper Clinic is an FQHC, we have a lot of ability within that mobile crisis response to connect folks to ongoing services to address the underlying needs that precipitate a crisis emerging and then escalating in the way that it did before Cahoots responded. I think the last thing that I'll touch on, as was mentioned, is our work with other communities. We helped set up the STAR program in Denver, which has been doing dispatch mobile crisis response 12 hours a day since June 1st. Additionally, last year in Olympia, Washington, Cahoots and Wiper Clinic were instrumental in the development of the crisis response unit, which has been receiving calls dispatched through public safety and responding with teams of two crisis workers for over a year now. We've also supported work going on right now in Oakland, California. We've had other conversations with different groups in New York City, Austin, Houston, even Victoria in British Columbia has expressed interest in really pursuing the Cahoots model of mobile crisis programming. You know, with that, you know, it's hard to really go in depth about the Cahoots program in 10 minutes. But with that, you know, I think I can turn it over to some questions on the model and the work that we're doing.
Great. Thank you, Tim. And like I said, if you have a question, you can hit the star button twice to unmute your line. Tim, one quick question I had is you mentioned in this the example in the story that you told. How is it determined? Is it determined by the dispatcher who get if the Cahoots team goes out, or is it the law enforcement officers who are on the ground who determine the situation?
That's a great question. The determination about sending Cahoots is something that happens with the call taker and dispatcher, and that allows us to capture not just the calls that are explicitly for Cahoots services, but those really unusual calls that are just coming through 911 either because that caller only has access to 911 to contact public safety, or whatever it is that they're experiencing feels so emergent that 911 to them is perceived to be the only appropriate number to call in that situation.
Great. Like I said, folks, if you have a question for Tim, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. I'll give it a moment.
Hi, this is Andre Sayer from Patterson.
Yes, go right ahead.
Thanks. So during this pandemic, we partnered with our county to repurpose our 211 system so that anyone who is seeking shelter will be provided not only transportation, but we will take them to one of the participating hotels in the area. Now, we have a large homeless population that congregates at a very busy thoroughfare. And more often than not, people want to participate in the program, meaning someone will call 211 or they'll call 211 and we'll get them to a hotel. But what happens when these individuals are adamantly opposed to getting in the car, getting to the hotel? How do you deal with people who just are reluctant to leave where they know?
That's a great question. And that's something that's really important that often gets missed is the value of community when we're talking about folks who are, you know, unsheltered or unhoused. For situations where we're talking with somebody and they're not really interested in what it is that Cahoots is offering, you know, we need to keep in mind that our service is voluntary. You know, we are not placing holds on folks. We are not doing diagnostic work out in the field. So So what we rely on is our ability to build rapport, you know, communicate with folks, and really the reputation in our community of providing services that are trauma-informed and under the auspices of least intervention necessary. So, you know, I might want that person to go stay in a hotel room. But if it's not raining, if it's not snowing, you know, if they're able to demonstrate that they can care for themselves and that they're not a threat of harm to themselves or others, then at that point, is the hotel room that I'm offering them really inflicting more help than they're willing to receive at this point? And are there other things that I can do to build rapport? Maybe it's that I need to just give them a card and a bottle of water and say, look, when you change your mind, call us back and we can come out and talk with you. In situations where there is external pressure for a specific outcome, you know, we can advise and inform folks of the, you know, potential consequences. So, you know, using that example of somebody who is unsheltered and out front of a business, for instance, you know, one of the things that we'll frequently be told is, you know, three different folks have called on this individual for a welfare check, including the business owner, who's advised us that if they don't move along, that they would like to pursue trespassing. And so we can go out and talk with somebody and say, look, you know, we're not going to force you to go with Cahoots. You know, you get to choose how you engage with us. We want you to know, as you make that decision, because you're the expert in your experience, you're the expert in your life, that if you choose not to engage with us on that ride to that shelter resource, that the business owner has said that they're going to call the police for trespass. So we, you know, we'll provide that information to the patient and then empower them to really make their own decisions about how they want to engage with Cahoots and you know, what it is that they want to do.
Thank you.
Tim, one question we had submitted via the online portal is, it's a two-parter. One, how large is the Cahoots team, and was there any initial pushback from getting law enforcement buy-in?
Yeah. So starting with the question on the size of the Cahoots team, looking at field services specifically, we have about 25 FTE, and that is staffed by a team of 40 individuals. As far as initial pushback, you know, there was some apprehension of having civilians using police radios. We operate on the same priority channels as law enforcement, but we're not sworn officers. So there was a lot of concern. Most of it, though, was really born out of fear for the safety of these civilian first responders. So what we saw early on in our services in Eugene, and again, when we expanded into the community of Springfield to really kind of flesh out our metro area response, was a lot of co-response, where officers were self-initiating to Cahoots calls and would go out under the guise of wanting to secure the same scene and really make sure it was safe for these civilian first responders to come in. What they quickly saw is that we were oftentimes able to de-escalate situations more quickly and with better outcomes, in large part because we were not law enforcement. You know, when Cahoots teams show up on a scene, we're wearing a t-shirt and a hoodie and some jeans. You know, we don't have a badge. We don't carry weapons with us. The vehicles that we drive don't look like traditional public safety vehicles. And it's that complete visual response that allows us to really maintain, you know, scenes without a lot of volatility. In those 24,000 responses that we had last calendar year, there were less than 150 situations that escalated to the point where we needed police backup. That's 0.6% of our entire call volume. So you know, really, where that there's that initial pushback from law enforcement around this isn't safe for those civilian first responders, we're able to demonstrate that we can actually come in and have a lot safer outcomes than patrol, even in interactions with the same individuals in similar situations.
Great. All right. Any additional questions? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you so much. This is super interesting. I'm curious about how the Cahoots team handles it when, you know, there's someone who's having, you know, a mental health emergency, but who also potentially poses a public safety risk. Like, how do you balance how much there's just Cahoots response and how much there's police response, and who kind of makes the call over which responders sure. defer to?
So that decision, again, you know, kind of lies within the hands of our dispatcher. For those really unusual situations where this seems like, you know, it's hitting 9 out of 10 points for a Cahoots response, but that 10th point is saying that maybe police should be responding as well, There's an opportunity before resources are dispatched to talk with the CAHOOTS responding team and to talk with, you know, watch command or, you know, supervisors from patrol about how are we going to approach the situation. For some of those rare situations, we will do a co-response where officers will be showing up on scene at the same time as the CAHOOTS van. And that's really there for that initial de-escalation. Generally, when folks see the CAHOOTS van, we get a different response than when a squad car pulls up. And that's because of the reputation that we have with our community. But it's still a really dynamic process for those, you know, those real extreme situations. And whenever possible, police are looking to hand a call over to CAHOOTS as soon as possible. So that's why, you know, for some situations, occasionally we'll see an officer go in just to make sure that the big stick that's being swung is put down, or at least there, you know, maybe not even have the stick get put down, but there aren't other bystanders that are in close proximity. You know, CAHOOTS teams are each CAHOOTS responder goes through 500 hours of field training and 40 hours of classroom time before they start working as part of that two-person response. And a good portion of that is really spent on compassionate communication and verbal de-escalation, as well as really robust situational awareness and scene safety. And it's that really kind of, like, as was mentioned in the introduction, it's that really in-depth training that has gotten us to the point where in the 31 years that we've been doing this, we've never had an employee injured during a patient interaction. You know, we've never even had a serious car accident or a collision involving our vans. And again, that all goes back to the level of training that we expect of our staff and the way that the CAHOOTS model engages with the patients that we're serving.
Thank you very much.
Any additional questions? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice.
Hi, this is Alice Forster from New Haven. Thank you so much for your presentation. I was just wondering how it's funded. Is it coming out of public safety dollars, or do you charge a fee for each visit, like an ambulance service?
So our services are funded mostly through public safety dollars. This is additional funding that is approved by our city councils and then is applied to the public safety budget for mobile crisis response. Whitebird Clinic, as the FQHC and the 501c3 nonprofit, is the contractor for the cities to provide that service. For the city of Springfield, which is smaller than Eugene, has a tighter budget than the city of Eugene. Those services are supported additionally by a grant from the state of Oregon, but that grant is set to expire in another 5 years. And so we are working with municipal leadership to find a way to keep this program funded in a way that doesn't, you know, take resources away from other city funded programs.
We have time for two more questions. If there are anyone else on the line?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, this is, this is more of a comment. I would love to see the algorithm that happens at the triage kind of space with dispatch. And then also thinking about scalability, for larger cities. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we're talking a lot about right now, is that scalability. You know, CAHOOTS is serving a metro area, like I said, of 250,000 people, and that's large compared to other cities, you know, some other towns and communities, but is a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, New York City, for instance. So as we look at this program, it's more about what each individual city, what each individual community's needs are, and how a program like this might scale for a larger population. You know, are there other resources that could be supportive of some of the things that CAHOOTS is doing in Eugene and Springfield, so that a similar program in, you know, I don't know, Virginia or Kentucky can focus on maybe half of the things that are in the scope of work for the CAHOOTS program as it exists here in Oregon, but still achieve, you know, similar outcomes. So, the one thing that we can say, you know, for certain is that from a cost standpoint, at least looking at where things are in Eugene, that for every 250,000 folks, you know, we need to be looking at a budget of around 2 million. So if we have a community that's got, for instance, a population of 4 million, it's likely going to cost 8 to 10 million to run the program. You know, the logistics of how that works out are really going to vary city by city, community by community. So it's, you know, it's a tricky question, and we're really trying to work to, you know, offer something that's responsive and can be tailored to the needs of each individual community. And as far as, you know, conversation on the dispatch algorithm, if you reach out to me at White Bird Clinic, I would be happy to, you know, spend some time talking with you about that offline.
Thank you.
All right, we have time for one more question for Tim. So if anyone on the line has a question, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Going once, going twice. So Tim, just before you go, if a city or county is interested in this approach and wants to learn more information, I know you're the director of consulting, so how might they be able to get in touch with you or somebody at the clinic to discuss more?
Sure. The easiest way to learn more about Kahoot and to talk with us about, you know, supporting work that you might be doing in your community is to just go to the website, and that's whitebirdclinic.org. Through that, you'll find a portal to request information and get in contact with our consulting team.
Fantastic. And I'll in the follow-up email, I'll include information to the website and your information as well. So, Tim, thank you so much. It's been an incredible presentation.
Of course. Thank you.
All right, folks. And our final speaker and presentation of the afternoon will be Asantiwa Boyki. Asantiwa is a registered nurse and will discuss the Mental Health First Sacramento program, which is a cutting-edge new model for non-police response to mental health crises. The goal of Mental Health First is to respond to mental health crises, including but not limited to psychiatric emergencies, substance use disorder support, and domestic violence situations that require victim extraction. Their purpose is to interrupt and eliminate the need for law enforcement and mental health crisis first response by providing mobile peer support, de-escalation assistance, and non-punitive and life-affirming interventions, therefore decriminalizing emotional and psychological crises and decreasing the stigma around mental health, substance use disorder, and domestic violence. With that, I turn the call over to Asantiwa. Asantiwa, the floor is yours. And you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. My name is Asantiwa Boykin. First, I'm honored to be in this space and grateful for the opportunity to present our framework to you all. I am the co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project and the program coordinator for Mental Health First. Just to give some context, that Mental Health First kind of existed in our respective community organically, right? When our friends or family members or comrades were having mental health crisis, calling the police was not an option, right? Or calling crisis services that were embedded inside the police also were not an option. So we took care of each other, right? So it came to a point where we were like, why can't this be something that's available to the larger community? As we continued our work combating police terrorism, we came to understand just by peer numbers that majority of folks that were harmed or even killed by police were the folks that were in the midst of a mental health crisis. For instance, Miles Hall in Concord, Joseph Mann in Sacramento, Antonio Thomas in Sacramento, Stephen Taylor in Oakland or San Leandro, Natasha McKinney, Michelle Couveau, and Corey Gaines. And that's just to name a few. So after several months of research, several years of experience doing it organically, we began to ask ourselves, why can't we do this, right? So we put together what we call a dreaming session. So what we did was imagine if money were endless and resources were endless, what kind of thing could we possibly build? And then also going through the heart-wrenching process of coming back down to earth and deciding on just a few things that were absolutely necessary. So our program is run by volunteers only. We have a staff of around 8 folks, including myself. We have a logistics manager. We have 2 medical directors. One is a family practice physician, and the other one is a family practice physician and a psychiatrist. We have someone who has our resource coordinator, who not only looked for the resources in our county, but vetted those resources. So when we give resources to folks, they know, and we know exactly what's going to happen when they make that phone call. What are the chances that there's going to be beds available or that there's not? Just so we're giving them a realistic expectation of the kind of services that we're referring them to. We are currently housed inside of a longstanding buprenorphine clinic here in Oak Park, which is a historically Black neighborhood, right? So we use their clinic during their off hours. Our current operating hours are 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. overnight. We identified those hours as the times where there were the least amount of services available. So that's why we wanted to live specifically in that space. We have a street team of about 3 folks, one being someone who is a medic, a nurse, and then we have our crisis interventionist, and then we also have a safety liaison. Beautifully, we have not had a shortage of folks with licenses, whether it be EMT, our nurses, our doctors, to fill in that medical person role. We've had medical students, seasoned attending physicians go out with our teams, which has been absolutely beautiful. And then also our crisis interventionalist. That person, we hope, is the one who builds rapport with the participant. And that's the language that we choose, because we understand that crisis management is a participatory and reciprocal relationship. It's not a descendant of those who know what's best for you telling you what to do, right? So that's why we use the term participant. But all of these positions are fluid, right? It just depends on whomever the participant just creates rapport with, and that should be their contact person. And then we also have what we call a safety liaison, and it is this person's job specifically to liaison with police if they happen to be on the scene, just so that our crisis interventionist and our medical person can remain focused on building rapport with our participant. And if the police aren't there, then their primary job is also safety awareness and also like communicating with community members. A lot of the times our family members, a lot of the times there's like onlookers. If it's really sensational, there may be someone recording. So we just wanted to make sure that there was someone who was there having conversations that our folks that are providing direct care would not have the space to do. We, again, are unfunded. We're volunteer run. We hope and understand that the folks who volunteer their time for us deserve to be paid. We've currently accepted a grant from Cal MHSA, which is Mental Health Services, which we're looking forward to be able to like implement and maybe start paying some folks, at least just to keep all the records together and upgrade our technology, which would be beautiful. We are also in conversation with Oakland, California about adopting our model. We have also had conversations in San Leandro, California, and we are also in current conversation with Sacramento, California about how we could possibly implement some of the principles of Mental Health First into our already existing mental health crisis response system. I believe one of the advantages that we have of being a newer program is that we are able to reimagine the pathway to prevention. We're also able to reimagine like the pathway to emergent care. The way that our current system exists, right? One, the police are heavily entrenched in it. And then two, there is this, there is an air of forced compliance, right? It's a lot of the times we approach our patients and say, just be normal. And if you can't, then we'll just medicate you until you're normal, right? So I think us being a newer program just gives us a way to reimagine what mental health care looks like. A lot of our current structures in mental health care And because we are peer-led, we have a peer council, we haven't come to some of these conclusions because we feel like we're smart enough. We've come to these solutions because, to these conclusions, because we've asked folks that use mental health services. And from what they say, even some of our most progressive programs still cause harm, right? And we believe it's our job to figure out how to provide this care and cause the least amount of harm as possible. And part of our current structure is actually taking our volunteers and asking them what their triggers are, discussing what our internal biases are, so that we don't end up replicating the systems that we are essentially attempting to dismantle. That is something that we are heavily, heavily married to. We talk about racism, we talk about sexism, we talk about phobias and the isms, and how does that show up when you step out of a vehicle to help someone, right? And making sure that we're not replicating the harmful behavior. We have felt extremely supported by the community here in Sacramento. We get our calls strictly by word of mouth, strictly via social media, and with no integration into 911, with no integration into dispatch, and we have a pretty hefty call value, especially those factors considered. So we're definitely looking forward to what it looks like to expand. We are already servicing a very large county, and yeah, it's beautiful work, and we appreciate being taken seriously, because initially it's like, what do you mean, no funding, no police, right? We got a lot of pushback around, like, what does that look like? And this is what it looks like.
Thank you, Asante. Quick question before open it up to the audience at large here. How'd you get the word out? I know you said word of mouth as situations arise, but how'd you get the word out within the community about the work you guys were doing?
I believe that it was the program is so audacious that there was a lot of press around it when we first launched. We did flyers, we did social media posts. We went to a lot of events. We went and talked to a lot of providers, a lot of community programs, and just told them that we were available and left our flyers on their counters. And we've generated a lot of calls from just community programs. So, and we've actually gotten calls from programs to help like mitigate crisis that that were happening within their building, right? Because they didn't want to call the police. They just wanted their, you know, their patient or their participant to just like calm down, or maybe have someone mediate. There's been a few times that we've been able to mediate conversations between like program staff and participants.
Great. And anyone on the line have any questions? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. I'll just pause for a second. And so I did want to, just from I know you guys said you just got to get a grant for a mental health services grant. What do you guys plan to do with that grant? Are you any plans for expansion? How you actually are engaging the local governments in Oakland, Sacramento, and San Leandro, et cetera?
So our current plan of action is to attempt to use one of the additional available like 1-1 numbers to be able to dispatch calls for us while placing someone who is like a mental health first staff inside of the dispatch system versus allowing the dispatch system to refer patients to us. We would have someone who is mental health first trained inside of the dispatch system. That way they know how to, one, they have our principles and our values, and they can kind of screen the calls that are coming to us and making sure that they are appropriate by our standards. We also hope to just provide our training to the community at large, even though like replication and being picked up by cities sounds awesome. It sounds super sexy. But we would really like to get this training into the hands of every single community member. That way they're not even reliant on us, right? So we want to do a lot of training. We want to hire someone who can help us facilitate those trainings. Again, like I said, upgrade our technology and do some more integrated kind of advertising, right? So we can just get the number out there to more folks.
Great. Any questions on the line? Can I unmute your line by hitting the star button twice? Going once, twice. Asanya, thank you so much, and keep up the great work you guys are all doing out there. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.
I want to thank all of our speakers today for taking the time out to come and present. This call has been recorded, so I will send that link around later this afternoon. Should you have any additional questions or want further information from anyone you heard from today, you can email me directly at wbishop, that's W-B-I-S-H-O-P, at cityhall.nyc.gov. Our August call will take place on Tuesday, August 18th from 2:15 to 3:15 Eastern Time, and we will talk to you then. Thank you, everybody.